It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Roman Catholic Diocese of Harrisburg became the first diocese in Pennsylvania to declare bankruptcy as fallout from the devastating grand jury report detailing sexual abuse of children by clergy. We're going to talk about what that filing means with WESA's Capital Bureau Chief, Katie Meyer. Katie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And also on the line from Harrisburg is Joseph Jafari, staff writer for PA Post. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
The grand jury report released in August 2018 revealed abuse by hundreds of priests in six dioceses. That's Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, Erie, Greensburg, Allentown, Scranton. Abuse in Philadelphia and Johnstown, Altoona were detailed in separate reports. So seven of those eight dioceses have set up victims' funds to provide relief for people affected by these abuses. Katie, what happened with Harrisburg? Did their fund run out of money?
So, no, they've paid out about $12 million, they say, to around 100 people. And they kind of couched that as, you know, that was a good faith effort to get everything resolved without lawsuits. But they say their you know, fiscal position, as it were, was depleted during their responding period to the grand jury report. And now they are anticipating further lawsuits. And so and they're being sued, for instance, in New Jersey, which just expanded its laws to allow more lawsuits. In Pennsylvania, lawmakers in Harrisburg are seeking to open a two-year window for lawsuits on old cases. That could happen as soon as next year if a constitutional amendment successfully passes. And also, there was this court decision. It was Rice versus the Diocese of Altoona-Johnstown that said basically statute limited abuse victims, so people who were abused a long time ago, they can't sue over specific, you know, criminal complaints, that kind of thing, but they can sue over institutional cover-ups. So the Harrisburg Diocese says it's looking ahead at potential new lawsuits that could happen. It still has some that are, you know, they were not settled with the Victim Compensation Fund, and so they are already proceeding. And so they said this is sort of a decision aimed at heading that off, and essentially, this is going to protect its assets.
Right. And, of course, the Altoona-Johnstown was covered under a separate grand jury investigation in 2016. So let's get more into the reasons cited for seeking protection from creditors. In this case, victims of abuse. How much in liabilities are they anticipating? Joseph, Katie?
Well, in their filing, they say between $50 and $100 million. So obviously, that's a pretty big range, but we can imagine it's going to be a lot of money. And they did say in the press conference about the bankruptcy filing that any one of the lawsuits that it's currently in the works could probably bankrupt the church in and of itself. So this is a lot of money we're talking about.
Yeah, they're expecting about, they say in their lawsuit they're expecting about five civil actions, and they estimate that there's about 200 victims right now that could come forward. Mm-hmm. So we are looking at quite a bit of money, but I think one of the biggest things that we're going to be questioning is how much money does the church actually own? You know, that kind of is the linchpin of the initial parts of this bankruptcy hearing is going to be about. You know, they claimed that they have between, like, I think, like, 1 in 10 million.
1 in 10 million, yeah.
But the problem is the fact that they just they released, you know, in their most recent financial audits that they have over $180 million in assets. Yeah. And so this really, and it kind of gets into a complicated, or not really complicated, but just like a bit of a loophole in religious law versus secular law and who owns property. And so we're going to see that kind of boil down to what actually is paid out and what is negotiated.
And yeah, those assets, that's not just cash, it's also properties, correct?
Oh, yeah, a lot of buildings. Actually, I saw a stat, and I hope this is correct. It was like the Catholic Church is one of the biggest property owners in the U.S.
In the world.
In the world, rather. Yes, so there you go.
But we don't actually know how much the Catholic Church owns.
Right.
You know, it's very opaque exactly how much each parish owns versus what the diocese owns,
right,
or different diocese own, and then what, of course, you know, the actual Vatican owns.
And then, Kevin, what Joseph was referring to is that, you know, the diocese is very large, but they say a lot of their assets, you know, all but, you know, at the most $10 million of their assets are owned by the parishes and by schools that are within the diocese. So when they file for this bankruptcy, the assets that can be used to pay back creditors, in this case, abuse victims, it can't be like school buildings. It can't be churches that are owned by the parishes. It's a real limited set of assets.
My Confluence colleague, Megan Harris, talked to Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto about the announcement yesterday afternoon, just as officials in Harrisburg were breaking the news.
Mr. Mayor, just moments ago, the Catholic Diocese in Harrisburg filed for bankruptcy. Did you have any idea that this was coming?
No, but I can't say that I'm surprised, given the reports over the past few years, the number of legal cases that are being taken against the church and against parishes. I don't think that it is a surprise that we would see this happen in one of the dioceses. I'm not sure what that will mean to others as we look towards the future, but it's not surprising, but as a Catholic, it is troubling.
Does it worry you at all what that could portend for the faith community here in Pittsburgh and elsewhere in the state?
Well, I think that the actions by the church over many decades has more of an effect on what it means to the layperson who finds themselves being spiritual, having faith, but questioning religion. And it's going to take decades to help to reverse that trend. I think that the Catholic Church does a good job in providing charity and assistance to those that need it, and probably could do a better job in getting that word out and being able to show what a big part of the community they are right here in Pittsburgh, throughout the state of Pennsylvania, and throughout this country.
Are you worried at all about that ripple effect? If, you know, some of these service groups that the diocese does work with, if the diocese here follows suit?
It would be devastating, to say the least. Catholic charity goes well beyond Catholic charities. The work that they provide throughout the city of Pittsburgh, especially for our most vulnerable, is not only critical to the city, but has been for over 150 years.
What has this felt like as the leader of the city, as a Catholic yourself, to look on as the church struggles in this way?
It's hard. I mean, you know, I liken it to the experiences that Penn State alumni had as a Penn Stater as well, after the Jerry Sandusky trials. It's more than a stain on a reputation. It hits to the very foundation of an institution.
Mr. Mayor, thanks so much.
Thanks.
That's my colleague Megan Harris talking with Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto. The Confluence did reach out to interview Pittsburgh Diocese Bishop David Zubik. Katie, did Harrisburg's bishop attend the press conference?
He did. So Ronald Gaynor is the bishop in Harrisburg. He kind of opened up the press conference, gave a little speech about, you know, he said he was very sorry to parishioners, very sorry to victims of abuse, you know, pretty unequivocally apologized. But he didn't take questions. He left after that and kind of left the questions to his lawyer.
Right. The Pittsburgh Diocese offered a statement instead of agreeing to participate in interviews. And the statement reads in part, quote, "Each diocese is a separate entity within the Catholic Church, and each must address its own unique economic situation. Bishop David Zubik continues to work with the diocesan administration in efforts to manage the financial affairs of the Diocese of Pittsburgh in an effort and in an appropriate and responsible manner, working hard to avoid having to make a similar decision." End quote. We also reached out to the diocese attorney and the Victims Compensation Fund administrator. There were comments, were there not, from the attorney for the Harrisburg Diocese that although Harrisburg is first, it might not be the last in Pennsylvania?
Yes, that's Matt Haverstick, the attorney who, one of the attorneys representing the diocese. And yeah, he said, I mean, listen, the problems facing the diocese here, they're not unique to this diocese. So, you know, we haven't seen specifically if there are any fiscal problems, financial problems that Harrisburg has that other dioceses do not have. Of course, you know, as you just said, they're all different. But, you know, the threat of additional lawsuits if Pennsylvania changes its laws, you know, priests who were in Pennsylvania diocese working elsewhere, other states who might have looser laws about lawsuits, changing legal standards for these things. This is all going to come into play. And so Haverstick said, yeah, you know, considering that landscape, he would not be surprised if other dioceses followed suit.
And just to jump in there, I mean, one of the things that we started seeing in 2018, and Go Erie actually reported on this, is that the Erie Diocese actually started transferring property ownership mm-hmm. away from the diocese over into parishes' properties as the pastor's ownership. And so that kind of suggested back then, and kind of even more as of yesterday, that maybe we might start seeing this happen in other dioceses across the state.
Right. In November, the attorney for the Pittsburgh Diocese, Robert Ridge, said in open court that bankruptcy is a possibility. It's the confluence we're talking about, yesterday's announcement in Harrisburg that Catholic diocese would declare bankruptcy. Joseph, you reported that the diocese used the phrase potentially significant exposure in filing for bankruptcy. Do we know what they meant by that? Is that financially exposed?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you're talking about a large sum of money that they claim that they don't have, and that you can kind of see that through their filings. But this isn't something that is, you know, unique to Harrisburg's case. This is something, so just kind of give some context. You know, Portland was the first diocese that actually filed for bankruptcy in 2004. And what they said is that they had assets of $20 million, but they had liabilities of over $373 million. You know, but the ruling in that case was basically saying that, you know, the bishop owned the land, not the parishes. And what you saw actually that they owned about $500 million. And so they claim that there's all these different liabilities, but it's really anyone's guess to see how the bankruptcy court is going to manage what these, you know, exposures and these liabilities actually are and what they actually own.
Is it possibly also that protection to, as far as exposure, to potentially release more details of abuse in court in a suit?
Well, so actually, one thing that's quite interesting is through the bankruptcy, it kind of acts as almost like a firewall for future litigation, right? And it has, there is some benefit for the Catholic Church to declare bankruptcy, because what it does, I mean, so the Harrisburg Diocese basically said, we think that there's 200 victims that may come forward. This gives all victims an opportunity to come forward right now and get an equal piece of the pie when it comes to the actual payout that might happen. That doesn't really happen when it comes, when if you know, bankruptcy is just decided and then somebody comes forward in the future. I mean, this is really a winner-takes-all situation where if you don't come forward right now with your sexual abuse claims, then you really don't have any access to money in the future. But this is also something that the Catholic Church kind of likes, because it's more of an equal opportunity, you know, kind of vestment of everybody who wants to come forward about their sexual abuse claims in the past.
Just a few minutes left. One of the first to react was Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Katie, what did he say, and how are those comments sitting with the diocese?
So Shapiro basically said that, and I'm just going to quote him here, he called the bankruptcy filing yet another attempt to deny survivors the justice they're owed by the church. So pretty unequivocal. He said that this is a legal maneuver for them to skirt responsibility and absolve themselves financially and avoid transparency in these matters. So what he's talking about is kind of what we've talked about, is they have a lot of assets that are held by the parishes. They have assets in other places. They are saying that's not party to this bankruptcy filing. They can only pay out this much. And so Shapiro says he doesn't buy that. This is just a tactical maneuver. The diocese, they responded saying, listen, we can do this under the law. And Matt Haverstick, the attorney for the diocese, said, you know, he basically was very unhappy that Shapiro, you know, the top law enforcement officer in the state, was criticizing people for obeying the law. So that was kind of their back and forth.
And one thing to kind of just add on to there is that, you know, they may be obeying the law, but we are talking about two very different laws in this situation.
Sure.
You're talking about canon law, so religious law that was established in the 80s by the Vatican, and then secular law. And so what we see a lot and across the nation when it comes to these bankruptcy cases is that many judges just aren't versed in canon law, and it's like applying a foreign country's
yeah.
law in these cases.
Yeah.
And so many are just kind of like hesitant to apply that law.
Yeah,
so
I mean, and there's precedent here, but it has really, I mean, things have varied by case.
Yes.
Just about a minute or so left. What reaction have you heard from victims, from advocates, parishioners?
Well, I think we're still getting you know, reactions. Brett Schultes, actually one of our other reporters, he went to a church last night and, you know, talked to some parishioners, talked to a bunch of priests. Actually, Brett found a bunch of priests leaving out the back door before we got in there for the press conference yesterday. So, you know, I think everybody's just waiting to see what's going to happen. People are worried that there is going to be financial impact, that churches could close down the line. The diocese says that's not in the plans right now, but who knows what could happen during the bankruptcy process. Right. So I think it's a waiting game.
Joseph, briefly, moving forward, what does this mean for victims in the Harrisburg Diocese who have yet to receive compensation?
So, I mean, so there are cases in the past that have been settled. Those people will get their money. But the cases that are currently in litigation, that essentially is put on hold right now. And it on those kind of claims, are their financial claims are rolled into their liabilities. And so they will be a part of this pool, essentially, of money that future people who want to come forward right now and look at these claims and make a claim against the church, that they will be involved in that kind of pool is available.
And we're going to have to leave it right there. Joseph Jafari is a staff writer for PA Post. And Katie Myers, WESA's Capital Bureau Chief, thanks so much for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. A Pennsylvania bat species whose population has been decimated by a fungal infection just earned a big win in court. Plus, the Human Rights Watch says 8% of LGBT people have been refused medical care. Coming up, we'll talk to a group of people working to provide quality care in their community with unique sensitivity. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Send your suggestions to confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I owe a lot of my musical taste to Kurt Cobain. The Nirvana frontman had a knack for pushing the spotlight away from him and onto artists he loved. The Incesticide liner notes introduced me to the Raincoats, while Kurt's t-shirt at the 1992 VMAs helped me discover Daniel Johnston. Nirvana's Unplugged album started my lifelong appreciation for the Meat Puppets and the Vaseline's. Today, in honor of the late great Kurt Cobain on the anniversary of his birth in 1967, I encourage you to dig a little deeper and learn about those who inspire the people that inspire you. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
A judge's ruling gives environmentalists new hope for the future of a bat quickly disappearing from Pennsylvania. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. In 2015, the northern long-eared bat was listed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, and a coalition of five environmental groups challenged that listing. They argued that the bat needed more protections because mining and other human activities removed forest habitat that the bats relied on, compounding population declines from the fatal bat disease white nose syndrome. So the bat should get the more protective endangered species listing. A few weeks ago, a judge agreed. I spoke with Ryan Shannon, an attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, which was part of the legal challenge, about the reasons the court overturned the threatened listing.
The first one was because one of the ways the service tried to justify their threatened listing was by saying that within 40% of the total geographic range, the bat was still doing okay. But this was a bit of smoke and mirrors because in its core range, the area where it was most abundant on the East Coast and in the Midwest, the species had already been absolutely devastated by white nose syndrome, with population declines at the time of listing of over 90%. And instead of looking at that 90% number in the core range, they decided to look at the geographic range. But that 40% number just was not reflective of the actual status of the species. And then the second reason was that the judge said that they failed to take into account the cumulative impacts of other threats beyond white nose syndrome. In the case of a species like the bat, where it has been devastated by something like white nose syndrome or another invasive species or some new disease, it may be the case that before that disease was on the scene, some of the other threats to the species may have been insignificant and the species as a whole could have withstood them. Once you accept the reality that the bat population is being decimated by white nose syndrome, we're in a situation where every single remaining bat counts. And so those threats that may have once been insignificant are now cumulatively significant.
And one of those considerations is habitat loss.
Yeah, that was the primary consideration.
So will this ruling by the judge mean that the bat will automatically be listed as endangered?
I think that that's the writing on the wall, but as a technical legal matter, no. What the judge said is that they have to go back and revisit their threatened listing and take into account both the devastation that white nose syndrome has done to its core range and its cumulative impacts. And hypothetically, they could reissue another threatened finding. However, I think it's clear both from the science and from the judge's ruling that they should issue an endangerment finding, barring some miracle like a known effective cure for white nose syndrome. I mean, obviously that would be a complete game changer and we'd all be thrilled to see it.
What could this ruling mean for the bat's numbers? Is it coming soon enough?
It's not coming soon enough. We petitioned for this species back in 2011. We think that it deserved the full protections of the act then. It took the service 4 years to finally issue the threatened ruling. We didn't think that was protective enough now. White nose syndrome has continued to spread throughout its range. And so this endangerment finding can't come fast enough. This bat is in desperate need of the protections of the act.
Ryan Shannon is an attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity, a spokesperson for the U.S. Department of the Interior, which oversees the Fish and Wildlife Service, says it's reviewing the judge's ruling. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to Human Rights Watch, 9% of LGBT individuals have been treated with harsh or abusive language while receiving medical care, and 8% have been refused that care outright. The Central Wellness Outreach Center aims to alter those statistics and better the lives of those affected by them. A note to listeners, the following conversation contains discussion about mature topics. Earlier this week, I spoke with Dr. Stacy Lane, the founder of the Central Outreach Wellness Center, Alex Titangelo, a nurse practitioner for the center's newest location in Aliquippa, and Brandon Dudek, a case manager in Aliquippa, where he also does community outreach. Welcome, folks. Good to have you all with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Dr. Lane, what gaps were you seeing in LGBT healthcare throughout Western Pennsylvania when you decided to open the first center on the north side in 2015?
I came to Pittsburgh around 2000, I think it was 2007. I originally worked at an HIV clinic. It was a time where the health insurances were not covering transgender care, hormones especially. Mm-hmm. As the internet became more and more common, I was noticing my transgender patients were buying things on the internet many times that we didn't even know what they were. They would bring bottles in with like Thai writing on them. So people were doing what they needed to do to get the health care they needed, sometimes in really dangerous ways.
Right.
The other thing was happened, I worked for the county health department in Allegheny County, and I worked at the STD clinic. It was my job after I left Allegheny General, and I was there for 3 years. And we didn't, we didn't swab every orifice that people were having sex in, mm-hmm. Or with. And we were the health department. And trying to have conversations and trying to get things changed so that we were more, and part of it was, you know, dealing with issues such as cost, et cetera, but trying to get people to understand the importance of that from a public health side was obviously very frustrating.
So why are these issues so important to you as a doctor, as a medical professional, as a person?
There's a long version and a short version of the story, but the shorter version is that my uncle died of AIDS when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I was 15 when he was diagnosed. He died when I was in my first year of college. And he was the patriarch of our family. And he got terrible health care at the time. There was very little that they could do. This is a time when only AZT was available for AIDS.
Right.
And to watch him deteriorate and have the sort of mistreatment by the system was what really drove me to make a difference and do things differently.
Mm-hmm. So you've expanded since the opening of that first center. After the north side was Washington County, and now the most recent one is Aliquippa. What does it take to open up a center like this?
Honestly, at the end of the day, it's not that difficult. I mean, getting started was obviously very tough. You know, my husband's a saint. He allowed me to use all my family's resources, really, and put it all the eggs in the basket to make sure that we were successful. I would say that financial resources are the easy part. The hard part is finding the right people.
The right providers?
The right providers, the right people that work in the clinic to create the right culture. Mm-hmm. Too few doctors that are trained in our standard medical system don't understand the concepts of harm reduction, of meeting people where they are, of being non-judgmental, of cultural competency. And finding doctors that get it are difficult, but also finding professionals that want to be trained and are open to being trained to provide this kind of care is also tough.
Alex, you and Brandon have stepped into leadership roles at the new center. What have been your priorities as you move into Aliquip and create a new environment for your clients? Alex, we'll start with you.
So the biggest thing we just want to foster is a really a safe place. You know, we do that by engaging the community. We have worked with some different organizations. There's a small organization called PRISM that helps LGBTQ youth, you know, and then we really just go the extra mile for our patients. You know, it's not easy to walk into a clinic and tell someone, about an STD or, about being positive or something of that nature.
Right.
So really just work hard within the community to let them know that our space is non-judgmental, it's understanding, and we're, just good people.
Brent?
I think just the impact of us being there. I have a Center Outreach logo, usually on my shirt, on my car, and people have stopped me. Oh my God, I heard about you guys. It's so great you're here. And for people to come and see the pride flags in front of our clinic, they're a little overwhelmed, honestly, and they can't believe that we've been able to create such a thing in Beaver County.
Mm. To either of you, what kind of needs are there in these areas for a center? Are you addressing different concerns, whether it's in Aliquippa compared to Washington County, compared to the north side? Are there different concerns, different needs?
So I think the biggest thing that we see is if you talk to anybody about the town that they grew up in, I grew up in Butler. Everybody always goes, oh, Butler, terrible drug problem. Oh, Beaver County, oh, terrible drug problem. Oh, the north side, terrible drug problem. So, it's every community that we deal with, we are always looking to reduce risk of IV drug use. So along with that, we do a lot of testing for hepatitis C. And with, IV drug use does come with certain drugs, promiscuous sex. Mm-hmm. So we're a clinic that's available really for anyone that needs treatment for hepatitis C, anyone that's sexually active, having one or more partners to come in and get a free STD screen, have a very open and non-judgmental conversation about, their drug use, about their sexual activity. So those are the biggest needs, that you can say about any community that we're engaging, mm-hmm. So Northside, Washington, Beaver County, all those areas, have a need for risk reduction, harm reduction. So
Stacy, it can be difficult enough to access healthcare in rural areas. I would imagine that access is even more limited for LGBT individuals or not.
Yeah, for sure. So when I opened up the Washington PA office, the reason that I opened that clinic up where it was my second office, and I had people at the time that were driving from both Ohio and West Virginia to get the services that we provided that they couldn't get where they were. I picked Washington PA because there was some state law that said that as a physician, you had to have an office within 10 miles of the state line in order to get reciprocity in that state to practice medicine with their insurances, et cetera.
Right.
So that was the unique thing. I know that when we opened up Washington County, and this is in 2016-ish, that we had over 50 people driving from West Virginia.
Mm. So what's the response been like at the Washington County facility?
Washington County's been there for a while. We actually are in the process. We just hired a second provider there. They see about 25 patients a day on a busy day.
Right.
I think that we work well with both the Washington GSA and the W&J down there, and they actually do very well. Same thing, kind of a community engagement. So I feel like we've been well received down there.
Brandon, well, let's turn to you then. I believe you're a Beaver County resident as yes. well. What have you seen so far in the response to the Aliquippa facility?
One of the things that impresses me is our number of transgender patients. And transgender patients from every walk of life, every age. And we've had quite a few people who have come to us and entrusted their hormone care, the start of their transition. And even though Pittsburgh is not that far away, I feel like they needed us to come into their community so that they felt comfortable, mm-hmm. You know, receiving that care. And once they get there, we welcome them with open hearts. We welcome them to the family. And it just makes a whole difference.
We're speaking with Dr. Stacy Lane, Alex DeTangelo, and Brandon Dudek of the Central Outreach Wellness Center. Alex, what steps do you take to ensure that your clients are receiving the considerate care that they need, that they deserve?
It's pretty interesting things that we do. You know, a big thing that we really like to make sure that we're really hitting home on is pronouns. So, you know, you may have someone that identifies as female, but might not be, you know, projecting as right. female. And it's very difficult for that person to, you know, walk into a doctor's office for the first time and, you know, correct you if you misgender them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the first things that we do is we always talk, we introduce ourselves, we try to give our own pronouns in a prompt to try to get people right. to give us their pronouns. We also have, you know, on our questionnaires, you know, tell us your pronouns. What's the name that you like to be called? You know, there's different things that we do just in basic screeners whenever people come in that you don't see at another doctor's office.
Brandon, you have a very personal connection to this cause. You were a former patient of Dr. Lane's. What from that experience do you use in your everyday work now?
So when I moved back here from San Francisco, I had end-stage AIDS and cancer, and I was really heavy into drugs, and I was really just trying to slowly die. I had lost all hope. So I stopped the medication and moved to my parents' house, and they convinced me to visit Dr. Lane. She was working for AGH and doing a monthly clinic, which, you know, by chance happened to be two buildings down from where our new clinic is. And I went in there and I was expecting a doctor to say, well, if you want to live, you're going to take this medication. I didn't want to live. But she really showed me compassion that made me care what she thought. It made me feel like she wanted me to get better. So I started taking the medication and, you know, here I am.
And you're with us, and we're so glad you are.
Yeah, and I always try and just share that compassion and that understanding and that meeting people, you know, where they are. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Lane, I understand that you recently opened a psychiatric unit at the Outreach Center on the north side. What new services can clients expect to see there?
We just implemented psychiatric care. We have a psychiatrist, Dr. Tamar Carmel, that's part of the community. And we have nurse practitioner, a couple of therapists, support groups. We have a trans support group now, and that program is really in its infancy. I'm learning a lot along the way, trying to set up. And as we, I think one of the things that we do differently is that we really care about people and realize that it's not just taking a pill every day. That's not health. Health is happiness. Health is, you know, having a reason to get up in the morning. Help is. You know, and there's a emotional and social side of health. And, you know, I think that for us, hiring people that are part of the community has been a big tenet of what I do as I build my practice, because I try to give people, and I want to be part of giving people meaningful jobs and meaningful work, which is why, you know, Brandon became part of my team. Mm-hmm. But as you talk about providing services, you know, we have a program right now for housing. We're trying to dip into housing. We have psychiatry, and we're trying to look at the whole picture.
The not whole just, life of the individual.
Right, because I can give out all the, you know, HIV medication in the world, but if you're not housed, you don't have food in your belly, if you're on drugs, none of it really is going to be very helpful. And HIV is easy to treat these days. It's one pill a day. It's very little side effects. It's no big deal in the grand scheme of things. If people are undetectable, they can't transmit HIV to their partners. It's really no big deal. But if you don't have a roof over your head, you don't have food in your belly, and you stop taking your medicines, it can become a big deal. So that's the kind of the bigger picture that we try to look at now from my practice, which might be a little different than other places.
Brandon and Alex, what impact do you two believe the Outreach Center as a whole and Aliquippa specifically has had so far? Alex?
I think it's been pretty overwhelming. You know, there's a lot of people that have come in that for years have been driving from, you know, Monaca, Aliquippa, all those types of areas into Pittsburgh, you know, to get the type of care that we provide. And, you know, people have come into our office and said, just like, thank God. Like, we're so thankful that someone is finally here in Beaver County. You know, we finally have a doctor that can take care of our HIV. We finally have a doctor, you know, that can do an STD screen and do a thorough STD screen. You know, it's just been, we've been pretty overwhelmingly received by, you know, Beaver County Behavioral Health, you know, all the other organizations that we hope to really, you know, develop very big relationships with so that we can connect people with the resources. You know, we've tried to really, you know, make that impact in the community. But just overall, everybody's kind of wondering why it took so long for Beaver County to get something like us. And I think we're really hitting the ground running with all of this and really trying to make a big impact.
Brandon.
I really see our clinic as much more of a community center, especially for the LGBT communities. You know, we're visible, we're safe. You know, there's people who wouldn't have this opportunity otherwise because of travel or just because of how their families are. And it's just great that we can have sexual health in Beaver County. We can offer free walk-in STD testing to everyone anytime.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lane, finally, in what other ways do you hope to see the Outreach Center develop in coming years? What's next?
Well, housing's always been a big thing for me, and I think that's something I really want to do. I also, you know, I think about spirituality and spirituality in the community. That you have a group of people that have been basically isolated from their religion and had to make a choice at one point of who they were. And many of them end up rejecting religion totally because of the terrible experiences that they had that have been traumatizing. And I think that that's probably not the way, you know, I'm a spiritual person. I'm a Christian. And I always struggle with that because this community has been hurt by religion. And religion owes it to this community to get them back. But anyway, so those are the sort of two things that I think about. Maybe a dental office, but I think that they need a sense of community. They need homes, and really building that the infrastructure to have a meaningful program that can fix some of these problems.
Dr. Stacy Lane founded the Central Outreach Wellness Center in 2015. Brandon Dudek is the case manager at the Aliquippa office that just recently opened. And Alex Tatangelo is a nurse practitioner in the Aliquippa Center. Thanks to all of you for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, State Representative Jake Wheatley wants to legalize adult-use cannabis for disadvantaged populations having trouble accessing medical marijuana. Plus, Carnegie Library downtown will be closed for the rest of the year for a major upgrade. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistants from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.